The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. We've invited E.J. Dion Jr. to return to the Free Library to continue our episodic dialogue on faith in the public square, which has featured past presentations by such notable thinkers as Stephen Carter, Richard Dawkins, Harvey Cox, Christopher Hitchens, and a friend of EJ's, Jim Wallace, to name more than a few. Dion's latest addition to the dialogue, Sold Out, Reclaiming Faith and Politics After the Religious Right, has been described by the New York Times as a deeply personal and searchingly intelligent reflection on the noble history, recent travails, and likely prospects of American liberalism. No? A columnist for the Washington Post, how's that? And regular commentator on NPR, Dion is a senior fellow in government studies at the Brookings Institution, as well as a professor at Georgetown University, where he teaches in the Georgetown Public Policy Institute. His previous books include Why Americans Hate Politics, Stand Up, Fight Back, and The Prescient, I Hope, They Only Look Dead, Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Era. Please welcome E.J. Dion, Jr.
Thank you so much for coming. I'll know progressives have won when no one laughs at the subtitle of that book. I love coming here. I was here before. I love Philadelphia, and I love this program that your public library does. My late mom was a public librarian, worked at a storefront library in my hometown of Fall River, Massachusetts, and I just love public libraries, and I really appreciate the work you guys do. And that was also a much more generous introduction that I received the other day when I was given a talk on politics, and the person introducing me concluded, "And now for the latest dope from Washington, here's E.J. Dion." So thank you for that generous introduction. I am also happy to be here because two of the interns who helped me with this book are from Penn. One of them was, at least, did Max get here? Max Nachman, are you here? No, he couldn't. He said he was going to try to come. So I thank the University of Pennsylvania as well. I'm going to give a talk about the book and about religion and politics, but you know, I've been thinking a lot about sort of different kinds of religious figures and different kinds of religious prejudice. So I've been thinking a lot about Al Smith. And one of my favorite Al Smith stories is he was a very clever politician. And he was speaking to a big crowd in upstate New York when he was running for governor once. And I like the tradition of heckling, which means I'm inviting anybody in the audience who wants to heckle me. And the heckler stood up in the back of the room and said, "Tell them all you know, Al. It won't take long." And being clever, Al Smith snapped back and said, "I'll tell them all we both know, and it won't take longer." The one thing I do know is that this crowd is not a single one of you fit into the category of another great political story that Mark Shields likes to tell of the political consultant who sits down with a rather mediocre candidate and looks at him and says, "You can fool all of the people you can fool some of the people all of the time, and those are the ones you should concentrate on." I like political jokes, and this book, it may be the only book on religion, at least the only book sympathetic to religion that you'll ever read, that begins with a joke. It is one of my favorite jokes about politics and religion, because it reminds us that the words Jesus and religious were not always reflexively associated with the words right or conservative. It is a story of someone some of you may have met in the course of your life. In this story, her name is Mrs. O'Reilly, and her son was dutifully taking her to the polls one election day, as he did every election day. Mrs. O'Reilly always voted straight Democratic. Her son was now upper middle class, called himself an independent. Actually, he voted for a lot of Republicans, but he still took his mother to the polls. And as always, he asked her one day, you know, one of these elections, Mom, how are you going to vote? And as always, she said, straight Democratic. And the son said, you know, Mom, if Jesus came back to earth and ran as a Republican, you would vote against him. And Mrs. O'Reilly said, oh, hush. Why should he change his party after all these years? And I think one of the reasons we're having a lot of these conversations about religion and politics is that a good number of Americans think he has changed his party after all these years. On significant parts of the right and the left, there is a sense that religion has always been a conservative force. There are Republican candidates and political operatives who assume that religious people live on the political right, care primarily, maybe only, about issues such as gay marriage and abortion, and will forever be part of the Republican political base. There are liberals, though I think fewer than many conservatives think, who buy this Republican account and write off religious people as backward and reactionary busybodies obsessed with sex. Now, Sold Out insists that faith does not lead ineluctably to conservative political conclusions. It argues that the era of the religious right is over. The collapse of the religious right, I believe, is part of a larger decline of a certain style of ideological conservatism that reached high points in 1980 and 1994, but suffered a series of decisive and, I believe, fatal setbacks during George W. Bush's second term. The end of the religious right does not signal a decline in evangelical Christianity. On the contrary, if a Catholic like me can use this term, I think it's a sign of a new reformation that is going on among Christians who are disentangling their great movement from a political machine. This historic change, I believe, will require liberals and conservatives alike to abandon their sometimes narrow views of who religious Americans are and what they believe. Throughout our history, our great traditions, and this is especially obvious in the Christian and Jewish scriptures with which I am most familiar, have preached a message of hope for more just and decent human arrangements. One of my favorite teachers mentioned, thank you, in the introduction, the theologian Harvey Cox, argued many years ago that the theological enterprise seeks to grasp the problems man faces in this historic present in light of the past, his past, and his future, that is, in light of faith and hope. And Cox was right, I think, to call on religious institutions to speak with pointed specificity to their age, to shape their message and mission not for their own comfort, but for the health and renewal of the world. Marx saw religion as the opium of the people, but that can only be true if religion is seen as utterly indifferent to what happens in this world, or becomes a kind of decent drapery to disguise or rationalize the already powerful. Such a faith would indeed be incapable of challenging injustices and indifferent to how God's children are treated by their governments, their employers, their societies. Such a faith would reflexively support the status quo by offering its blessing to whatever happened to be fashionable or to whoever happened to be in power. But that is not, I believe, the faith of the scriptures, and it is certainly not my faith. The title of my book, Sold Out, the product, by the way, of a family trip to the eastern shore of Maryland, an intense consultation among my wife and my kids and myself. I'll tell you the story afterward, but I really needed the help because my wife gave the title to my book, Why Americans Hate Politics, which is one of my favorite book titles. So I said she had to help me off the hook again. And Sold Out is a product. Sold Out, as my publisher always tells me to note, is spelled with a U. And that title can be read in two ways. On the one hand, it speaks to our country's exhaustion with a religious style and politics that was excessively dogmatic, partisan, and ideological. It's a style reflecting a spirit far too certain of itself and far too insistent on the depravity of its political adversaries, linking religion too closely to the fortunes of one political party or to one leader or group of leaders is always a mistake. It encourages alienation from faith itself. Where, after all, did Voltaire come from? Where did the new atheist writers who have become so popular come from? It does this by turning a concern with the ultimate into a prop for temporal power. It distorts great traditions by requiring their exponents to bob and weave to accommodate the political needs of a given moment or the immediate requirements of a given politician. A great many people, including a great many religious people, and including a great many of theologically conservative people, have had enough of this. And they've had enough because of the other sense embodied in the title. Reducing religion to a narrow set of public issues amounts to a great sellout of our traditions. It is common to speak of religion selling out to secularism or to modernity or to a fashionable relativism. But there is a more immediate danger, I believe, of religion selling out to political forces that use the votes of religious people for purposes having nothing to do with a religious agenda, and often enough for causes that may contradict the values such voters prize most. It is a great sellout of religion to insist that it has much to teach us about abortion or gay marriage, but little useful to say about social justice, war and peace, the organization of our work lives, the death penalty, providing for the sick, the old, and the desperate. Religion becomes less relevant to public life when it is marginalized to a predetermined list of values issues, when its voice is silenced or softened on the central problems facing our country and our government. You may all recall that exit poll question in 2004, when voters were given a choice about why did they cast their ballots, and the choice included moral values or Iraq or the economy or taxes or education. Now, first of all, I ask this to every audience, which is, did any of you cast ballots in 2004 on the basis of immoral values? I have yet to find anyone in an audience who answered yes, but I've been waiting for that person because I really do want to invite them out for a drink after this talk is over. But think about what that structure of that question said. If you cared about Iraq, either because you believed morally that we had to get out and end the war, or you believed morally that we had an obligation to see it through, but didn't check the moral values box, you didn't care about moral values. If you cared about the education of the next generation of kids and checked education, you were presumed not to care about moral values. If you cared about social justice or what was happening to people in the economy or the fairness of the tax code but did not check moral values, you were not regarded as a voter who cared about morality or values. There's something fundamentally wrong with that approach to religion and morality. Voters worried about poverty, the war in Iraq, or the justice of our tax system are, in fact, just as concerned about values as those voters concerned about abortion or gay marriage. I once debated Ralph Reed when he was head of the Christian Coalition, and I said, you know, Ralph, I will always defend your right to base your political conclusions on your religious faith, because in many ways my own beliefs have come out of my religious faith. But you must explain to me one thing. Where in the New Testament did Jesus call for a cut in the capital gains tax? I simply cannot find it in my own. Now, the idea that the religious winds are changing is one of sold-out central themes. Over the last two decades, much of the public discourse, as I've said, has been premised on religion as a right-wing force. This idea totally defies the history of our nation. For after all, our people of faith were at the heart of movements for civil rights back in the 1960s. Without the African-American church, the civil rights movement would have been much the poorer and less organized. Religious people were at the heart of the movement for the abolition of slavery. Religious people were at the heart of the progressive movement. Teddy Roosevelt ended his speech at the 1912 Progressive Party Convention, "We stand at Armageddon and we battle for the Lord." And the Lord in that speech was assumed to be a progressive. Once upon a time, the media paid a lot of attention to a broad range of religious figures. Think of Reinhold Niebuhr and Paul Tillich, Karl Barth, John Courtney Murray, Billy Graham, Martin Luther King Jr. Beginning in the late 1970s, the focus of interest narrowed. To be sure, Pope John Paul II earned his share of coverage, but in the United States, the attention lavished on Pat Robertson and the late Jerry Falwell and James Dobson suggested that to be religious was to cling to only one set of ideas. The public voice of religion, as reflected in the supposedly liberal media, was deeply inflected with the accents of a largely Southern conservative evangelicalism. I believe the future of religious engagement in American public life will not be defined by the past. In the new millennium, fresh religious voices are rising to challenge stereotypical views of religious faith. And I'm not just referring here to my friends, progressives like Jim Wallis or Amy Sullivan or Bob Edgar, or others who have joined them in speaking eloquently on behalf of those who are progressive and religious. There is also Rick Warren, a religious and political conservative, who nonetheless insists that if Christians do not care about the poorest among us in the world, these Christians are not being true to their faith. There's great, by the way, any writer who comes to you and mentions Rick Warren is actually committing the sin of covetousness in his or her heart. Because Rick Warren, as some of you may know, is the author of a book called The Purpose-Driven Life. The Purpose-Driven Life has sold somewhere around 25 or 30 million copies. And if I tell you nothing else that's true tonight, I know it's true that sold out will never sell 25 or 30 million copies, unless each one of you commits to buying about 10,000 copies each, which I welcome you to do. Rick Warren is a theological conservative. He is opposed to abortion and gay marriage, and yet he does care passionately about the poor. Encouraged by his wife, he has organized a large mission to help the victims of AIDS in Africa. And to discuss this work, about a year and a half ago, he invited two prominent senators to his church who were very engaged in the effort to eradicate AIDS. One was Sam Brownback, a good conservative Republican from Kansas, and the other was a young senator from Illinois named Barack Obama. Well, when Rick Warren invited Barack Obama to his church, I don't think it was the heavens, but it felt like the heavens fell upon him, because a lot of people among his conservative allies said this was a scandalous thing to do. Obama was a liberal, he was pro-abortion. And Rick Warren didn't back down, and he said, you know, people ask me, are you left-wing or right-wing? He told this to ABC, and he said, actually, I am for the whole bird. And I think what you're seeing is the emergence of whole bird Christianity and whole bird religion. Another person I write about in the book is Rich Cizik, a loyal conservative, a top official of the National Association of Evangelicals. Rich Cizik insisted that a concern for life entails an engagement with the stewardship of the earth and the problem of global warming. And he put global warming on the top of the list of concerns at the National Association of Evangelicals. He came under a lot of pressure from sort of political conservatives saying this dilutes our other issues. And Rich Cizik sort of brought it to his board, and this board, which I can assure you is not like the board of MoveOn.org, voted 37-1 to say, yes, global warming should be of central concern to Christians. And just one other person I can't resist mentioning is Bono, who once said that he could be considered a man of the cloth only if the cloth were made out of leather. And yet he, too, has challenged Christians to stand up for the poor. Indeed, he's challenged all of us to stand up for the poor around the world. Now, I think the 2008 campaign will be remembered for many things, but one important aspect of the election is a change in the political landscape regarding religion. The transformation is visible in many ways. The emergence of Mike Huckabee put the fear of God into the Republican establishment. I should say I have a small bias here because those of us who are political pundits sometimes get things wrong. Some of you may think we often get things wrong. In January of 2007, I wrote a column saying that Mike Huckabee was the dark horse to watch in the Republican primary. So I was actually pleased to see him last longer than most of the other folks. And I had the experience of Mike Huckabee's campaign manager coming up to me later in the year. He said, that was a great column you wrote. We sent it out to all our fundraisers. And I said, but, you know, I'm a liberal columnist. What good Can I do you with those guys? And he said, look, you go with what you have. And at that point, you were all we had. But think about what Huckabee did. Huckabee, I think, is someone who kind of has one foot in the old religious right and one foot in the new disposition I see going on. On the one hand, he did often talk about abortion and gay marriage, the traditional list. Yet when he talked about abortion, he often argued that a concern for life had to include a concern for human rights around the world. He said that pro-lifers should be concerned not just with the baby in the womb, but also with the baby under the bridge. As Barney Frank once said famously, life does not end at birth. And Huckabee took that very seriously. He was no William Jennings Bryan. His national sales tax plan was kind of wacky, in my view. But Bryan would have appreciated Huckabee's attack on politics as a mere extension of economics. Think also about John McCain's nomination. John McCain was nominated in the face of opposition pretty much across the board from the leaders of the religious right. Most of those leaders endorsed other candidates whom we're not hearing much about these days. Pat Robertson endorsed Rudy Giuliani and, as far as I can tell, performed no miracles last year on his behalf. I think these events suggest that the white evangelical electorate is tired of taking orders from politicians who care more about protecting the wealthy than ending abortion, more about deregulation than family values. And as I say, this new evangelical electorate cares about a much bigger list of issues than the ones we have become accustomed to talking about. And the Democratic Party is changing, too. In Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, the Democrats have had candidates who are thoroughly religiously literate. They're believers who are comfortable in discussing their faith and its implication for their views on policy. I do think that Barack Obama this year has developed a certain sympathy for Job, an empathy for Job, because I don't think anybody has been more tortured by questions involving religion. First, he went through a period when people were saying falsely that he was a secret Muslim. And then when the Jeremiah Wright controversy happened, they realized, oh, yes, he's a Christian. That is the one favor I think the Reverend Wright may have done for Barack Obama, but he was the wrong kind of Christian, a lot of people were saying. Yet Obama has been, I think, more thoughtful on the subject of religion and public life than an awful lot of other people who have come along. He gave a powerful speech in 2006 in which he criticized liberals who dismiss religion in the public square as inherently irrational or intolerant. In the same speech, he caught the other aspect of the new mood when he added, no matter how religious they may or may not be, people are tired of seeing faith used as a tool of attack. They don't want faith used to belittle or divide. They are tired of hearing more screed than sermon. And for her part, Mrs. Clinton has been very open about the importance of her Methodist faith since her time as First Lady. It's something that goes back to her childhood, and she risked criticism from her own side some years ago when she said that even supporters of legal abortion should be working to reduce its incidence. I think this moment can be seen as involving a quest for a new religious balance. This is not about driving religion out of the public square. It is about rethinking religion's public role. It is a corrective, not a repudiation of that public role. I do not assert in the book that religion is or always should be liberal. On the contrary, I note some very important affinities between our religious traditions and the conservative tradition. But it is also true that American liberalism cannot be understood apart from an understanding of its religious sources. What I want to conclude on, and because I'd like to sort of go into a longer Q&A here, is to assert that liberals and conservatives alike are going to be going through a substantial change, and I think we are we may, after a very difficult presidential campaign, be on the verge of ending the religious and cultural wars that have plagued us for too long. But to end those wars, we need passion and we need humility. These two virtues do not always come together, but they must. We need a passion for moving our nation out of a period in which public problems went unsolved and the possibilities of broad alliances were lost because narrow political imperatives triumphed over the idea of a common good. And we need humility to understand how prejudices of believers against unbelievers and unbelievers against believers have obstructed our path and blurred our vision. One of the heroes of my book is Reinhold Niebuhr. I love Niebuhr for his understanding that both human progress and human frailty are part of the human story. One of his great aphorisms, some of you may remember, is that man's capacity for justice makes democracy possible. Man's capacity for injustice makes democracy necessary. We can aspire to self-rule because of the noble side of our nature, and we want a system that can check the powerful when they get out of hand because of the less attractive side of our nature. The final enigma of history, Niebuhr wrote, is therefore not how the righteous will gain victory over the unrighteous, but how the evil in every good and the unrighteousness in the righteous is to be overcome. We must realize that self-righteousness is the enemy of righteousness. And you don't have to support Barack Obama or to pick a fight with St. Paul to believe that hope is the virtue on which faith and love depend. Let's be honest with ourselves and with each other. Religion can create community, and it can divide communities. It can lead to searing self-criticism, and it can promote a pompous self-satisfaction. It can encourage dissent and conformity, generosity and narrow-mindedness. It can engender both righteous behavior and self-righteousness. Its very best and very worst forms can be inward-looking. Religion's finest hours have been the times when intense belief led to social transformation, yet some of its darkest days have entailed the translation of intense belief into the ruthless imposition of orthodoxy. But the history of the United States, despite many outbreaks of prejudice and nativism and self-congratulation, is, I think, in large part a history of religion's role as a prod to social justice, to inclusion, and to national self-criticism. I'd like to close with two views of religion's public role, suggesting that at its best, it is prophetic and challenging, often dangerous to the powers that be, and friendly to those who are oppressed and heavily burdened. The first is from Michael Walzer's wonderful book, Exodus and Revolution. Walzer argues that the Exodus story has provided Western thought with one of its central themes of oppression and deliverance, of the idea, as Walzer wrote, that the door of hope always remains open. We still believe, Walzer writes, or many of us do, what the Exodus first taught about the meaning and possibility of politics and about its proper form. First, that wherever you live, it is probably Egypt. That sentence grows on you when you think about it. Second, that there is a better place, a world more attractive, a promised land. And third, that the way to that land is through the wilderness. There is no way to get from here to there without joining together and marching. And listen to the historian Richard Fox reflecting on the work of Niebuhr and one of my favorite historians, Christopher Lash. Both of them, Fox said, understood that religion can be seen as a democratic social power, a capacity to build community, and as a tragic perspective that acknowledges the perennial failing of human beings to make community endure. Religion allows people to grapple with the human mysteries that neither science nor politics can address, but it also provides a force that science and politics can draw on in their effort to understand and transform the social world. Martin Luther King taught us that the arc of history bends toward justice. And for that reason, I believe that the engagement of faith in our public life has been primarily a force calling us to higher standards, greater justice, and to a commitment to community and to fellowship. We are moving, I think, into a re-engagement with faith's prophetic role, into a time when believers and unbelievers come together, as they did in the civil rights years, on behalf of great projects of civic renewal and reform. In long run, faith should unite us more than it divides us. It should lead us not to complacency but to action, not to arrogance but to an acceptance of our public responsibilities, not to a certainty that God is on our side, but to a humble quest to act in a godly way in an imperfect world whose betterment requires us to act in hope. Faith and hope should promote in us a glorious dissatisfaction with the world as it is, so that we can envision the world as it might be, not a perfect world, but a better world. Self-satisfaction and arrogance are not the calling of faith. Dr. King drew on the prophet Amos in the speech offering his own dream. "We are not satisfied," Dr. King said, "and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream." This is the standard of faith, of hope, and of love. This is the obligation of those who decide to declare their allegiance to a just and loving God. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. We're going to have mics on both sides of the audience. What I'd love to do, just to save the folks kindly carrying the mics around from having to run hither and yon, if we could identify one person right away and the second person so that somebody can have a mic in their hand to ask the second question while we'll stay one ahead. So this gentleman I saw first, so why don't we bring him a mic? Who wants to be everybody's over on, oh, right back there. We'll stay on this side, and then we'll move over that way. Sir.
Thank you. A quote and a question. Richard Niebuhr said that religion was a good thing for good people and a bad thing for bad people. I think that might be appropriate. Then there is the theory going around, and I'd appreciate your comment, that our leaders don't really down deep care very much about what they do, i.e. that they might possibly precipitate Armageddon or the rapture, because it's okay, they'll end up sitting at the right hand of Jesus in heaven no matter what happens. Is there any validity to that theory at all?
Well, thank you for your question and for the mention of Richard Niebuhr, who's another hero of my book, who had a lot of interesting things to say about religion and democracy, particularly in the early 1940s, when that was a very important issue to be talking about. Personally, I think the rapture is questionable theology and much worse politics. I don't know how anyone is quite so certain about which end of the rapture they're going to be on anyway, but that's, I believe in humility. I'm not sure. I would not assert, as those of you who may read my column, though, I am very, very critical of George Bush. I oppose the war in Iraq. I don't think those are the assumptions of this administration. I don't think that this war happened out of religious assumptions. I think they happened out of mistaken political assumptions, excessive optimism, for one thing, about what an invasion would produce. And so I don't believe that. In fact, in my book, I make the case that, especially in his formal speeches, Bush is not all that different in the way he talks about religion than other presidents. There's no president, few presidents spoke as often or as movingly about religion as Bill Clinton. In the book, I cite a president who quoted St. Paul, "We are all part of one another," and gave this beautiful speech that seemed to lead to sort of compassion for each other. And then the book, I asked, does it annoy you when your president talks this way? If you do, that was Bill Clinton speaking in the Metropolitan Baptist Church in 1997. So I don't think Bush, when he's off the cuff, he is a little less careful about what he says about religion. And when he, where I do fault him is he was asked by Bob Woodward if he had consulted his dad before going in Iraq, and he said something like, I consulted my true father, my heavenly father. And as I told my kids in my students in my religion and politics class at Georgetown, I said, look, I'll never criticize a president for praying before he makes a decision, but I sure wish President Bush had called his dad before he made this decision. But I don't think, I think there are folks who do believe in the rapture, but I don't think they are the people who run our government. They're making mistakes, in my view, for other reasons. Who's over here? Or who has the mic already? Yeah. And then pick somebody over there. Thank you.
Thank you for coming to the Philadelphia Free Library. I'm concerned about the propensity on both the left and the right to be so absolute in their views, and I'm curious what you would say. I saw as an example, I favor and support gay rights, and yet it's my understanding that the gay right proponents in Massachusetts with the approval of gay marriage forced the withdrawal of Catholic social services from providing adoption services because of their refusal to provide adoption services to gay couples. And I cite that as an example of where I think it's, you know, too far in its extremity.
Yeah, that case is very interesting. I viewed it in a slightly different perspective. My understanding is not that the gay groups forced it, but that the law that of the state prevented that sort of discrimination. And I know some folks in Catholic Charities in Massachusetts who felt that there were ways in which they could have remained part of this. I mean, Catholic Charities are among the most effective social service organizations in adoption and in caring for poor kids. And I was hoping Catholic Charities would find a way to remain involved in this. Also, just in defense of gay couples who adopt, again, I looked into this because the whole controversy bothered me as it bothered you. A lot of times, people who are gay or lesbian were adopting the hardest to adopt kids. They were taking care of, you know, kids with all sorts of problems. And the notion that we would tell people who love kids who were taking kids who were very hard to get adopted that, no, you can't adopt them, I don't think that makes sense either. And so I wish I am a critic of sort of culture war politics, and I do sort of want to have less of this sort of conflict. On abortion, in the book, for example, I talk at length about where I think that debate should go. And where I think it should go is toward finding ways to reduce the number of abortions. That I think, you know, I argue both to my pro-choice friends and my pro-life friends. To my pro-choice friends, I say, it oughtn't to be that difficult to understand why some people in the country believe that abortion is a moral problem, at least to understand that, to understand why people worry about what happens to the fetus. To my pro-life friends, I argue it's not hard to understand why pro-choicers are trying to defend the autonomy of women and worry what would happen if abortion became illegal, because my fear is that if it became illegal, it would not reduce the number of abortions as much as it would drive abortion underground. But so where can you go with that without being, you know, mushy or wishy-washy? And my argument is that if we devoted ourselves as a country to substantially reducing the number of abortions, we could actually make considerable progress. You can do that on the one side by reducing the number of unintended pregnancies, and it's one of the great victories of social action, social policy, and changing mores that the teen pregnancy rate in our country has dropped enormously in the last 15 years. And on the other hand, to help poor women who want to bring their kids into the world. Former Senator Bob Kerry gave a great talk in which he spoke about, tried to have the audience imagine a single woman who worked in a factory in North Carolina who suddenly discovered she was pregnant. And he sort of asked the audience to imagine two situations. Under one, she has a job, she can care for the kid, and she has health care to help her through the pregnancy and help the child. On the other side, she loses a job, loses health care, loses the capacity to support the kid. Under which circumstance is she more likely to choose life? Under which circumstance is she more likely to bring this child into the world? And it seems to me if the dialogue goes in that direction, a lot of the things that liberals believe about what our obligations are to the least among us would actually advance an agenda that many right-to-lifers would support, which is to reduce the number of abortions. So I use that as an example of where I would like to see us sort of pull back from the culture wars and try to reason together toward a better set of outcomes. Sir?
Yes, you had mentioned that you thought that the evangelical right-wing conservatives had lost influence recently, or their influence was on the wane But do you have any worry, and you gave some good examples to support that, but do you have any worries that they have become institutionalized as a feeder system into our government from some of the Christian universities and appointments under the Bush administration, like several Justice Department appointments in particular, and all the way through faith-based initiatives, all the way down, I've heard even the congressional page system has a religious feeder element to it. So have you seen that at all?
Well, certainly. I mean, you know, evangelical Christians wanted to enter the mainstream of public life. In Ralph Reed's phrase, they wanted a place at the table. And I don't think we should have religious tests against anyone, including evangelical Christians. So it doesn't bother me at all that they have found roots into political positions. I don't want them to win elections and have power over many issues where I disagree with them. My colleague at the Washington Post, or former colleague, Hannah Rosen, wrote a very interesting book about, I think it was Patrick Henry University, and about these kids, these students entering, public life. So yeah, I think there'll be plenty of conservative Christians in, public life, but there always have been conservative Christians in public life. What I care about most is what issues are they most worried about, and what heartens me about younger evangelicals, and you see this at the evangelical colleges all across the country, is that the focus of the next generation up is much more on the sort of broad set of concerns that many of us have about poverty, about religious liberty around the world, as I say in Rick Warren's case about AIDS. So I see that community changing. I would venture that in this election, if he is the nominee, Barack Obama will substantially increase the Democratic share of the vote among younger white evangelicals. I'm not saying he'll carry that vote. For a lot of reasons, white evangelical Protestants are going to stay Republican, but I don't think the margins are going to be the same as they were. There are these institutions. They are institutionalized. But I think the old kind of Falwell, rest his soul, Robertson, Jim Dobson kind of conservative movement is really not where the action of the future is going to be. And I think, and obviously this is also a hopeful comment, that some of the very kids who have entered out of these evangelical schools may play somewhat different roles than we would have expected them to 10 or 15 years ago. Who has the next mic? This gentleman over here. And then there were some folks in the back there who wanted to get in.
I've been listening to you, and you're extremely rational.
That's a very nice thing to say, I hope.
And as a consequence, I really think you are somewhat delusional.
I knew something was coming. Didn't you know that?
I don't mean to be, insulting or anything. Is that
people have called me worse.
and the example, I suppose, is that one of the jokes that stories that you told about the survey where they asked that question about, moral values. See, and you gave a very rational explanation of this essentially semantic foolishness. The problem, though, is that for most of the people who answered that question and answered moral values, they did not give it the depth of rational analysis that you had. They knew exactly what was meant by it. They knew it meant abortion, gay rights. They knew it. Just as the people, what do you call it, who cheered for Ronald Reagan when he talked not about racism or segregation, but states' rights. No. So while you saw the foolishness of it, they had no. They understood exactly what he meant and what they were voting for.
Could I respond? Are you done? I don't want to cut you off. I was just thinking, if I had a choice between being rational but delusional or irrational but non-delusional, which way do I want to go? But I appreciate that. It's a good point you make. First, and I wish I had it at the tip of my finger, somebody actually did a subsequent study of what people meant by moral values. And it turned out to be more complicated than you or I might think, which is for a significant group of people, it was exactly as you say, that it was about abortion or gay marriage or some on the pre-approved list of moral values issues. But for a lot of other people, they were thinking more about whether the person they regarded the person they were voting for as personally moral or having a good moral character. And it's one of the reasons why a lot of people, a lot of Americans say they want a religious president, because they believe that religion is linked in some way to morality. Now, my own personal view is I know plenty of non-religious people who are extremely moral people, and I probably have an argument with folks on that issue, but I understand the linkage. But in the same, there was a survey once where the same group of people were asked two questions, which is, on the one hand, you want your president to be religious. 70% said yes. You dislike it when politicians talk about how religious they are. 50% said yes. There's an overlapping group there, and you want to ask the question, well, if you want him to be religious, how would you know he or she is religious unless they talk about how religious they are? But I think that also pointed to a kind of healthy ambivalence, which is, you know, there's a certain amount of religion people want in public life, and there's a certain, you know, there's a certain way in which if it's too much or done in a particular kind of way, they are unhappy. But the argument I'm making, which I think is empirical and not just sort of deductive, is there really is evidence that people who might 5, 10, 15 years ago have largely confined the words moral values to a narrow list, have now come to a much broader list and are thinking of other issues like how we treat the least among us as part of the list of issues they're voting on. And I think many of the new evangelical preachers, another interesting guy called Joel Hunter, who has a big church down in Florida, who has made common ground with moderates and progressives on a lot of issues. There was a recent manifesto put out by a group of Christians saying that they are opposed to the over-politicization of Christianity. So I think the trends I am talking about are not just the product of my own wishful thinking or even a delusion, but reflect something that's really going on in the country. And we'll learn a lot in a few months. You know, perhaps I will come back and apologize and say I was all wrong about all of this. But I don't think so. Mike Royko, some of you may remember, was a great columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times, and he put out a collection of his columns with a great title. The title was, I Could Be Wrong, But I Doubt It.
This dichotomy, which the Democrats constantly, every Democratic talking head constantly refers to, is that all of the major, you know, every major issue, call it, the Democrats have it on health, the economy, et cetera, et cetera. But those same people may very well likely vote Republican for the presidency.
Well, if you ask the question, the Washington Post recently asked, which party do you trust to solve the major problems facing the country? Democrats had a 21-point lead in the same poll. Obama had a 7-point lead over McCain. So there's a gap. There's a gap between the two. The number may be, at the moment, may be high enough that McCain cannot overcome it. And I think some of it will also depend on how people see McCain, as well as Obama, come election day. I think in 2004, enough people decided to vote on terrorism or decided they just didn't like John Kerry for whatever reason that President Bush won. My own theory of that election is there were two majorities in the country, a narrow majority that was kind of inclined to fire President Bush and another narrow majority that just couldn't get to John Kerry. And the Bush campaign was smart enough to activate the second majority because they felt they probably couldn't get the first majority. So I'm not shocked that the president's popularity has come down the way it has, because, you know, he won that election with 50.8% of the vote. But anyway, that's for another discussion. But thank you for the question. Some of that gentleman over there, and then there was a hand. Thank you.
In my Boston days, my favorite congressman was the man we addressed as our Father who art in Congress.
Father Greinen.
Hallowed be thy name. And we loved him and were dreadfully disappointed when he was urged to step down by the Vatican. All the quotations you've given us have been from Protestants and not Catholics. You self-identify as a Catholic, and while I don't expect another priest to be elected to Congress, it'd be nice to hear of some semblances of liberalism coming out of the Catholic apparatus in the country.
Oh, amen to that. Father Drynan, by the way, was what people don't realize is that part of John Paul II's legacy is Barney Frank in Congress, because when Father Drynan had to leave, Barney Frank took his seat. And there was in the 1972 convention, the McGovern convention, right? And in the 1972 convention, Father Drynan headed the Massachusetts delegation, and the first thing they did was to vote to change the name chairman to chairperson, and then they elected Father Drynan. And so the mayor of Cambridge was a woman named Barbara Ackerman, and she was trying to figure out, what do you call our chairperson? And she just got up and addressed him as Reverend Chair Father Sir. My book is very Catholic. I really didn't talk about the Catholic parts. I have two very long chapters, one on John Paul and Benedict, because I spent a lot of time covering the Vatican and am fascinated by these two figures. And the second is subtitled The Agony of Liberal Catholicism. And that, if I were to lengthen my list of, sort of progressive voices within the religious community, one of them would certainly be Father John Ryan, who was came to be known as Father New Deal. He was one of the principal authors of the Catholic Bishops' 1919 Program for Social Reconstruction, which, when you go back and look at it, was almost like a draft of the New Deal. Almost everything the bishops were for in that 1919 social program. And that the Catholics have always had an interesting view, because they've never been state socialists, but they have never been pure free market capitalists either. They've long seen the limitations of a market uncorrected by government and by other forms, not only by charity, but also by government and by social insurance. It's funny, in the book I have a long description of the letters that the Catholic bishops wrote in the mid-80s, one on war and peace and one on economic justice. And they were seen as very, very progressive or liberal at the time, so much so that a group of conservative Catholics actually wrote an alternative letter to what their own bishop said. I always tell my conservative friends, they say the liberals are the cafeteria Catholics, but you never like the food in the cafeteria when it's about economics or about the death penalty and the like. And when I put that section in the book, my editor said, you really need that. And I said, I may not need it, but I want people to remember that, because we have forgotten the role of Catholic social thought and the progressive nature of Catholic social thought. The whole idea of a living wage and a family wage was deeply embedded in Catholic social thought. The labor movement was in a sense a creation in part of the socialist movement and in part of many Catholic organizations. The Catholic Church was very important in the labor movement. So I have a lot of folks in here. I quote, there's a great theologian called Johannes Metz, who was one of the early theologians of hope, and that gave rise to liberation theology later on. But, I think that, as a liberal Catholic, I was very upset by what happened in 2004, because I think a few very outspoken bishops who believed, and I don't believe they did this for political reasons, I think they really believed it, that abortion trumped all other issues, created the impression the Catholic Church had joined the Bush campaign. I went into my own church one Sunday, and there was a little leaflet by this group called Catholic Answers, which is this conservative group of no one fully knows who funded it, but it looked like a religious tract, but actually it said there were five non-negotiable issues for Catholics, and guess what they were? They were abortion, gay marriage, stem cell research, assisted suicide, and human cloning. They didn't say vote for Bush, but they might as well have said that. And actually, when I went in, I saw this, and I said, Monsignor Duffy, my pastor, he wouldn't want these back here. And I put them in my pocket and took them out. And then, not being a guilty Catholic, I didn't want to do this without acknowledging it. And I
told, I will get to guilt in a second. The, you know, and I told him I had taken them out of there, and he said, I've been trying to get those out of the church all year, so I've been right about Monsignor Duffy. So I think we need a revival of this, social Catholicism, if you will, but it's out there. There's a group, there are a bunch of groups out there. Catholics United for the Common Good is a very interesting group. Pax Christi, probably more pacifist actually than I am, but they are very thoughtful progressives. I mean, there are a lot of Catholics out there fighting this fight. Just on guilt, I also argue in the book, proving that I'm Catholic, that I think the church's job is to make all of us feel guilty about something. And that, you know, I do think liberals need to think hard on family values and abortion and the life issues, and I think conservatives need to challenge themselves on poverty and inequality, and questions such as the death penalty. I once suggested as a fundraiser that we have two Catholics with a sense of humor and two Jews with a sense of humor, have them debate each other over whose guilt is more profound. I asked a Southern Baptist friend if she would moderate, and she said, no, I can't do that. You don't know what Southern Baptist guilt is like, she said. Someone over here.
Yes, you have spoken at length tonight about the beneficial effects of involving religion in public affairs and public policy. But I'd like your comments on the concept of church and state separated by a wall for the benefit not only of the state, but of the church.
I'm very glad you put it that way, because people forget that the whole purpose of one of the central purposes of church-state separation is to protect religious institutions from the state. People often talk as if it's only to protect the state from the influence of the church. And what I say very explicitly in the book is separation of church and state is one thing, separation of religion and politics is another. You need some very, very bright lines to prevent, you know, excessive entanglement between religion and the state. I don't believe in religious tests. I actually wrote a column. There were very few issues on which I agreed with Mitt Romney, but it troubled me that his Mormonism was, it seemed to be an obstacle to his election, because I think anyone in a religious minority, whether you're Jewish or Muslim or Catholic, and in fact in the United States, in some sense, we all belong to religious minorities, that you don't want religious tests used against anyone. Of course, I remember as a little kid what happened to John Kennedy, and I don't remember, but I've read about, you know, viciously anti-Catholic campaigns against Al Smith. So, you know, and now a friend and I are working on a project together on the whole idea of faith-based, you know, where our government can help faith-based institutions and where you draw the line. And what we're trying to do is look at, if you were to try to do this right, how would you do it? What lines can't you cross? For example, there may be a very successful drug treatment program that is based upon, you know, converting people to Jesus. Now, and it may have passed all the tests of being a successful program. A conservative friend of mine said, well, why can't you allow that? Their program has Freud, we have Jesus. But, you know, I would argue that, no, you cannot use government money to promote active conversion. On the other hand, we have used indirect support in all kinds of areas. You can go to Yeshiva or Notre Dame with a government student loan. I don't think we want to abolish that. The government has indirectly supported quite a lot of child care, particularly for the very young. And so I think that we can have certain cooperation between government and our religious institutions in an effort to solve social problems, but there are lines that we don't want to cross. And, for example, I don't want prescribed prayer in public schools. Why don't you want that? Well, you don't want it to protect religious, because you want to protect religious minorities. One of the great, Walter Dellinger, who was the Solicitor General, said that when he was a kid in North Carolina, there were two Catholic kids in the class out of 50, 40 Protestant kids. He said, the good news is we didn't have to get Protestant religious instruction. The bad news is while that was going on, we were assigned to all the dirty jobs in the school. You know, and so you don't want it for that reason, but you also don't want it for the very reason that was implicit in your question, which is the disrespect for religion. I mean, what would be a broadly acceptable prayer now? What would it be? Holy Mother, Father, Life Force? I mean, it would be a scandal to all religions at the level of generality that you would have to, go. So I do believe there is a big difference between separation of church and state and the engagement of religion and politics. And just lastly, I mean, otherwise, what do you do with figures like Martin Luther King? What do you do with figures like the abolitionists? What do you do with the Berrigan brothers? There are so many people who have been driven to political action from their faith that I think many of us look back on, and some of them we would disagree with, some of them we would agree with. But I do not see how you can tell someone, even people you disagree with, that you can't bring the energy created by your faith or the concern created by your faith into the public square. But you can tell them that you can't force me to be anything or use the state to convert me to anything. Let's see. Oh, over there, sir.
I found your comment about Obama's being the wrong kind of Christian.
That wasn't my
view. No, I understand, but your perception of what... Right, quite fascinating. I do realize, of course, it's not your exact view, but the responses of many voters and the media as well. And I wonder if you could expand on that. And before you do, if I may, just a quick sort of sketch, sort of biographical sketch, if I may be so bold. I grew up on the main line outside of Philadelphia. Like Obama, I'm the product of private schools and Ivy League universities. Indeed, I went to Penn. I'm an Episcopalian in a predominantly white church in Bryn Mawr, and very, very much aware of the realities of de facto segregation in patterns of worship in Philadelphia. Right? Sunday is a place where whites go to various areas to worship and blacks go to other. And so I think that that is particularly detrimental to both groups insofar as there's a lack of dialogue. And insofar as I think amongst the whites, there's a sense in which perhaps the blacks are not quite theologically literate in some way, that in some way they're not quite as socially, culturally astute. They don't belong to the Marion Cricket Club. That's a little place outside of Philadelphia. But they're not quite savvy socially. And I wonder if that in turn becomes a political liability for black politicians. But also what this can, if you can just sort of shed some light on this, these kinds of issues in light of Obama's speech and in light of the other kinds of changes that are taking place on the ground.
Thank you very much for that question. As you know, Martin Luther King said that 11 o'clock on a Sunday is the most segregated hour in America, 11 to 12. And so that is true. And I think some of the problem with how the Reverend Wright was heard by most of us has to do with the difference in these traditions. And I do not say that as an apologist for the Reverend Wright. Some of the stuff he said I found as outrageous as most people did. And yet what we didn't pay enough attention to is the great tradition of protest within the African-American church. And I think one in Obama in that speech on race said something very important when he said that, you know, when black people talk to black people or white people talk to white people, they will often say things to each other that they don't say when they are talking across these lines. And since Obama himself is of mixed race, it was almost like he was trying to get, argumentative members of his own family to talk to each other. After the first round of Jeremiah Wright stories, I cited a new book, by the way, which I commend to you, by Jonathan, it's called The Word of the Lord is Upon Me. It's about the preaching of Martin Luther King, and what he calls the public performances of Martin Luther King. I went through that book after the Wright controversy broke, and some of Martin Luther King's speeches were as angry as the Reverend Wright's speeches, particularly about Vietnam. And he said that God's judgment would come down upon us. And he did talk about genocide. He didn't use the word genocide. He used a similar word. I mean, they were very tough speeches. And I said that I didn't think my conservative friends who were condemning Wright and praising King would have defended Martin Luther King in that era. In terms of this sophistication issue, I'm not sure I would cast it that way. I want to think about that. I mean, theologically, I think the levels of sophistication are there's unsophistication in many different kinds of congregations. I do think that the African American church has been politically very savvy, partly because for a long time in our history, particularly in the South and particularly during slavery, the church was the only area of free social action that was really under the control of African Americans. The black church in the South was kind of like the Catholic Church in Poland under communism. And so it's played this very powerful political role. And in a lot of ways, the white religious right is modeled after the political action that was sort of that was pioneered by many of our African American congregations. The last point I'd make on that is that it is a pet peeve of mine. So you gave me an opportunity to let it out, which is people say evangelical Christians are conservative. Well, when they say that, they've never been into an AME church, and they've never been into an African American Baptist church, and they've never been into a Church of God in Christ or a Pentecostal church. That African Americans are as evangelical as anybody, you know, as a group, are as evangelical as white evangelicals are, and yet we assume that the word evangelical means one and only one thing politically, and African Americans put the lie to that, and that we shouldn't accept that as part of the normal discourse just because it's not true. But thank you for the question. I'm told I have one more time. How long do I have? One more. Can I just, since we can do two at once, each of you, if you can keep your question short, I'll be signing books, which, of course, you're each going to buy those 10,000 each, and I'll be happy to take questions out there also. But let's just, if you both could ask a question, then I can evade whichever one that's most dangerous.
Given the topic of your book, I'd be very interested to know what you think of the mythology that's grown up since the birth of the nation as to the role of Freemasonry in the establishment of the American government, right down to the design of our money and the layout of Washington and the active role of presidents in Freemasonry. I'd just be interested to know how that fits in or doesn't fit into your thesis.
You know, that's the one I'm going to evade, partly out of a lack of knowledge. I've read a little bit about the anti-Masonic movement. I've read the Da Vinci Code and some of the Dan Brown books, where he has fascinating things to say on this, but I'm not sure Dan Brown, as entertaining as he is canonical on the subject. It's a fascinating issue about which I don't know as much as I probably should, so I apologize for that. No, thank you. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm a Democrat. I went to an evangelical college. I actually graduated in the same class with Monica Goodling.
College could I ask?
Messiah College.
Uh-huh. Oh, Messiah, just up the road.
Yeah, just up the road.
I spoke there once.
It's a great place.
It is. They had the dialogue between Clinton and Obama.
Yeah, the Compassion Forum, just last month. And I think, so part of me, the person that went to the evangelical college in me, kind of my heart gets strangely warmed when I see Obama, right? Because we have this Democrat who can use evangelical language. But I've since been to seminary and done PhD work in theology, and now I'm thinking that the New Borean in me says, I don't want liberals or conservatives, like, sort of using all the flowery religious language. You know, Bart talks about wanting to starve the state of piety so it can chasten it. And so I'm just wondering, who do you see in the public square as Niebuhr's children? Because I don't look on the left or the right and see many Niebuhrians. I see kind of different shades of crusader at times.
By the way, you have your dissertation, if you haven't written it yet. I think it would be a great title, Niebuhr's Children. I consider myself a very, very, very imperfect child of Reinhold Niebuhr. I mean, I have the same feeling you do about him, as someone who is a really powerful guide to the way we should look at politics. But you know who also loves Reinhold Niebuhr is Barack Obama. And I actually interviewed him on this during the Jeremiah Wright business, and we were talking about religion. He said something about how, his church was, a wonderful institution, but it obviously wasn't perfect. He went on like that for a bit, and he said, that sounds like Niebuhr, doesn't it? Now, he could have been pandering to a Niebuhrian, which I am, he is, but I don't think that was just that. So I do think there's some Niebuhr in Obama. I'm trying to think of who else. David Price, somebody who's written actually about this, is a Democratic congressman from North Carolina, whom I quote in my book. In fact, I will quote Price to close this out. He got a PhD in political science and a degree from Yale Divinity School. He is very Niebuhrian. I think there's a Niebuhr revival going on right now. I mean, my friend David Brooks, whom I disagree with on a number of issues, he is also a Reinhold Niebuhr fan. We might read him. I think we read him in many ways the same way, but in some ways in a different way. But I think this is going to be a Niebuhrian moment. And I think if you listen to, you know, if you go back, and I talk about this a little in the book, Niebuhr's notion of, on the one hand, the United States has an obligation to act in the world, but it has an obligation to act with humility and with an understanding of its own frailty. And there are certain Niebuhr quotes where if you read them in light of the Iraq War and you say, boy, I wish we had read Niebuhr before we went to war in Iraq. And it's not that Niebuhr was a pacifist. He rejected pacifism. It's not that Niebuhr rejected American power. He accepted that it was important in the world, but he also believed in a sort of chastened America that understood the dangers of its own power, even as it used it in fear and trembling. And so thank you for allowing me to close with David Price, Abraham Lincoln, and Reinhold Niebuhr. Because to me, one of the finest expressions of the proper role of religion in public life is in Lincoln's second inaugural address. Now, think about it. This is a president who, if anybody could claim that he was on God's side, this is a man who saved the Union and ended slavery. He's speaking after 4 years of carnage in the Civil War. But Lincoln does not do that. Here's what he said in his inaugural address. He said, "Both sides read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. It may seem strange that any man should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces, but let us judge not that we not be judged. The prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully." Now, my friend David Price cites Niebuhr on this, who said that this passage puts the relation of our moral commitments in history to our religious reservations about the partiality of our own moral commitments more precisely than I think any statesman or theologian has put them. Lincoln, Price notes, expresses the moral commitment against slavery in uncompromising terms, along with the determination to finish the work we're in, but there follows the religious reservation, the recognition that ultimate judgment belongs to God alone, the refusal, even in this extreme instance, to presume an absolute identification between his own cause and God's will. And I think that sense of self-doubt and humility is something religion does promote and should promote. And just a little bit more of it in our public life, I think, would make us at least a little bit better. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.